The following Dharma talk was recorded in May 2014 in Excelsior Spring, Missouri. It is one of 21 recordings from the retreat called Insight Dialogue, taught by Gregory Kramer. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Gregory Kramer is the founder and guiding teacher of Metta Programs and has been teaching insight meditation since 1980. He developed the practice of insight dialogue and has been teaching it since 1995. Gregory is the author of numerous books. Find out more at www.metta.org.
As meditative qualities develop, there's this gift that just happens of pleasant mind states and ease, comfort in the body, and even when some qualities like concentration are highly developed to the point of absorption, even pain vanishes. And that's something that is accessible to us when we train in it, you know, when we develop the path of practice in that way. The Buddha called that pleasant abiding here and now. And given how difficult life can be, both having a body and just being in the complexities of relationships and so on, it's a really beautiful, valuable thing. The meditative qualities also enable the arising of what we might call wisdom, what we might call an understanding of things as they are. And the wisdom that comes up, let's say, naturally, that one just immediately apprehends as a result of strong mindfulness, steady concentration, investigation, and so on, is, you know, it's just there for the picking. One encounters, for example, the fact of impermanence in a very intimate way simply because the mind can come out of its gripping that holds the constructing process together, and you see that process at work, and that's the kind of the fundaments of impermanence, is this ultimately not just emptiness of self, but emptiness of any substance whatsoever. It's all change, you know, like physics says, this kind of thing. Neuroscience is the same thing. Buddhism says the same thing. It's not news. And one also can begin to see, let's say, how other people are like we are, often in pain, and one begins to see the hurt around one naturally, just by cultivating the mind. You don't have to practice metta or compassion or any of these things for this to happen. If you do, it may develop more quickly or something, but it's here for the picking. In light of this, come see for yourself here and now visible quality. one could ask, what is the value or the purpose, the function at all of something like Buddhist teachings that says something like, this is something about how it is. Take a look. If you're going to discover everything naturally, why do you need such teachings? See what I'm saying? It's often likened, and I think it's a good analogy, to someone who has, let's say, really become familiar with a certain forest and all the trails and streams and rivers and so on. And someone else comes and they could walk all over the forest and it might take them 40 years to get familiar with that forest, but maybe eventually they would. Maybe they wouldn't. Maybe their legs would be too weak to walk that much, or a bear would eat them, you know, whatever. But if they came to this fellow who had been in the forest 40 years and did have strong legs and did walk all over the forest and did have a great memory and said, okay, yeah, this trail goes here, this trail goes here. Why don't you have a look down here, see what you find? Sometimes letting you discover, sometimes, you know, saying, there's a gradual incline over in this part of the forest, and you'll notice when you get up there that there's quite a view that you didn't expect. You know, different details of the topology and so on. And you may never have discovered that part of the forest because it was on the other side of a river and so on. Or like I said, maybe you didn't know how to swim, and this guy knew how to swim. He could teach you how to swim. The Buddha knew this forest of the heart really well. Not because he was a god, because he was a human being. Because he looked inside and he saw the forest that you're sitting in right now, that I'm sitting in right now. This was the same forest for him. He had a liver and kidneys and, you know, a squishy brain. He had all those body parts, all those hormones. And he lived in a world that was just as ragged as the one we live in some ways a lot worse, in some ways. And it seems to me, anyway, that he was extraordinarily developed in his understanding, you know, in the traditional literature you see, you know, all the lives that he prepared to get there. I don't know about that stuff. I'm not saying it's not true. I just don't know about it. But for whatever reason, this was, in my opinion, an extraordinary being, human being. And not only were his meditative attainments extraordinary, his intellect was extraordinary. So he could translate these attainments and the vision that naturally came to him just by walking around the forest, just like everyone else. There was a certain understanding, a perspective, a view, you might say. That he said, oh, okay, I kind of see some of how this works, this human experience. And there's an incline over here, and there's a river over here, and, you know, so on and so forth. And so we may or may not get to certain parts of it because maybe we don't meditate as much as he did. That would be about the nicest thing we could say. You know, maybe our minds are not as vast. Maybe we weren't born into a body that could do the kind of striving he did, you know. We didn't live at a time with certain teachers. You can talk about all kinds of reasons. It really doesn't matter at all. The question is there something of value to be pointed out? And if we touch what's being pointed out, as closely as we can, will it let us know the path and say, oh, okay, this is really damp and dark and dangerous, and this is really bright and clear and beautiful, you know, or whatever you, however you want to evolve that analogy that falls apart when we talk about freedom. But there are certain pitfalls and there are certain potentials. There are certain dynamics of the body-mind that can be named. That doesn't make them true. It makes them observable, and then you see for yourself what actually is true. Because the naming of it is, as always with these words and concepts, it's not the thing. It's just another construct, this Dhamma. As beautiful, as exquisite as it is, as natural as it seems to me to be, it's also still just a construct. But with one with, in my experience, profound value. In our practice, on this particular retreat, you know, we've been touching the development of the body-mind in a practice, and we've been doing so in community and with each other in such a way to perhaps touch some of the pleasant abiding here and now, such as it is. Maybe it's not exactly those absorptive states, but, you know, possibly you've touched some pleasant experience. And possibly you've also touched with either by what you have found naturally yourself of the nature of experience in your own mind, your own heart. Maybe you've also heard something offered and you've looked over here when the contemplation said, have a look over here. And you said, oh, that's useful. And something maybe gives way or shifts. And usually in a retreat, on the last full day of retreat, I wouldn't offer the teaching I'm about to offer. But I have a sense that taking in this particular piece of Dhamma, of Buddha Dhamma, that says, have a look for yourself over here, but I'm giving you some suggestions, not me, you know, the Buddha, giving you some suggestions, have a look over here. And if your practice has stabilized enough, then maybe you'll actually look over there and maybe something, a benefit will be known. Maybe something will let go. I don't know. That's not my work. That's your work. This teaching is on tanha, or hunger, craving, thirst. It's a teaching that's often offered in a very general way, because in any way you offer it, it's quite powerful. But if we unpack it enough from the teachings of the Buddha and benefit from this relational lens as well that we are touching in this practice, perhaps it can invite a real sense of how these teachings can land and be revealing and liberative. One of the sort of unspoken bargains you make with teachings like this is if you give yourself to them partially, they can be nice or helpful or interesting. And that's what you come back with. That's how the heart transforms, is that much. And if you give yourself to them fully in each moment with diligence of practice, which is different than sort of following the pleasant abiding here and now kind of thing, but you really take the teaching to heart, then the full fruits of them are available to all of us at astonishing depth. And depth is defined individually for each of us. There's no objective depth in that sense. The tanha, which literally means thirst, I use the word hunger because we can relate to it better, I think, in this body, this culture that we live in. The hunger that gets the most airplay is the first that the Buddha named, kama tanha. It's the hunger for pleasure. And it's a good thing that it gets a lot of airplay because it drives us so intensely. And also underlies the other two hungers for being and not being, or becoming and non-becoming, which I'll talk about in a moment. And to understand this kama tanha, this hunger for pleasure, and to investigate it ourselves in meditation practice and insight dialogue and make it real, we really want to get the texture of hunger. We really want to get, without backing away, the ubiquity of it. Everywhere we turn, this organism is hungering for pleasure, and hungering for pleasure has the mirror image of the turning away from pain. Because, as one of my teachers, Ajahn Soban, used to say, the ending of the painful is pleasurable. The ending of the pleasurable is painful. So in seeking pleasure, we're also navigating away from pain all the time. We're doing it right now. You shift positions, you're doing it. You look away from someone who's looking at you, and it's something's disturbing. It's like unpleasant. You seek to adjust the temperature, you're doing it. You seek to get better food, you're doing it. You adjust your pillow at night. This is, you know, and then there's the, you know, the really big stuff, of course. The hungering for sexual pleasure and the hungering for, art and music and all those pleasures. The hunger for intellectual pleasure. So I want to stop even here and say how quickly this can become a concept and move away, and we can say, oh yeah, tanha, I know what that is, or something like that. This tanha is so powerful because this organism is so sensitive. So if you've touched your sensitivity, you've touched the, you might say, the fuse of tanha. It's like every touch of light on the eye, sound pressure changes in the ear that brings sound. Every touch on this cloud of nerves that run through the body, this taste on the tongue, and the molecule, single molecule, landing in the nose, the slightest thought touches the mind. So sensitive is this organism. And this is how we're born. This is how it is. This is a fact of being born. And it's always true, and it will be true until you die, at which point you'll be like a lifeless log. But this is it, this sensitivity. You can't get out of it. To recognize the directness, the immediacy, even the intensity of that fact of being in this environment, so sensitive all the time. And you see that these, you know, the organism is configured to go towards the pleasure and go away from the pain. And that's what we're doing. From the moment we emerge from the womb, that's what we're doing until the day we die. Can you feel that? I mean, it's like it's relentless. There's no break in the normal mind. And the spectrum of pain is vast. You know that scale of 10 that they use in hospitals? You know, at 10, you're like just about unconscious. It's totally... I saw my father when he had late stage cancer, and he couldn't move, he couldn't speak, couldn't do anything. It was like I had never seen it before. All the way down to 1, you know. Little things, little itches or little, and everything in between. But that 10, what does that say? It's a ridiculous construct when it comes to the experience of anything over a 6, maybe, you know? The spectrum of pleasure is astonishing. Satisfying the itch or, you know, gee, these frozen peas are a little better today than yesterday. All the way to, you know, consistent bliss that's like, you know, the whole organism is actually agitated by bliss. And how do you quantify that? You know, you can't. But all the time we're moving in that space, in that pleasure-pain space, going towards the pleasure. Now, a key piece that we see in this practice, as the mind becomes more sensitive in traditional meditation, of course we see the sensory pleasure and pain, and we come to a new relationship with it. That's one of the, to me, the great beauties and fundamental gifts of Vipassana meditation, is how we relate to sensory experience. In relational meditation practice, like insight dialogue, we also notice the pleasure and displeasure, pain of interpersonal contact. And we're doing the same thing. We're navigating. How can I get the pleasure? How can I stay away from what is scary, dangerous? And I don't even know why it feels dangerous to, let's say, be with you. Right? The mystery of the brain-mind is beyond us, but that's happening all the time with every glint. You know, glimpse of another, and in a whole group, or in a family. You know, you start looking at all the urging for pleasure and the avoiding of pain in families, and what do you get? I don't know what you get. Families. You know? And family systems therapy, and, you know, all kinds of stuff. But that's how it works. And so you can see how this then drives behavior. It builds the character over time because we develop preferences and, you know, a sense of this is how I've arranged to get my pleasures. This is how I've kind of constructed things to avoid pain. And all of a sudden, this me is taking a, you know, beginning to feel like the center of a sensory world, completely, and driven by that, and I move through life until I die and become a lifeless log, compost. Kama tanha, hunger for pleasure. What gets a little less, well, a lot less press is the bhava tanha and also the vibhava tanha. But I'll start with bhava tanha, the hunger for becoming, the hunger to exist, the hunger to continue existing. And we can see the hunger for survival, right? And it's operating in such a way that we have all kinds of built-in mechanisms of the nervous system and the motor system to help ensure survival that have evolved over millions of years. But that really only catches the most obvious tip of the iceberg, the survival of the body. So let's touch back for a moment into sensitivity. Okay? So here we have these eyes, these ears, the nerves, this overpowered brain processing the world, moving through the world, and from infancy, from the moment of birth, taking in all of that. And what's happening is with every contact, there's registration. And that pattern of registration that's also forming our knowledge of what's safe and what's not, what's pleasurable, what's not, is forming the urges and tensions associated with getting and not getting those pleasures and pains and so on. And those tensions and urges begin to form more massive, if you want to talk in kind of a pop neuroscience way, you know, neural networks and networks of networks form is one way to talk about it. When the science gets old in 100 years, that'll sound ridiculous, but right now it sounds all very cool. And those patterns of patterns begin to find stability in this world where we're constant, where the senses themselves are constantly rising and vanishing, and we have to freeze in perception. Ah, this is what I see. We learn what objects are. We learn how to navigate. All those patterns of knowing how to navigate become, you know, developed in the mind. And how do we navigate our relationships and how we navigate our food and our bowel movements and everything all becomes part of it. And so these networks are constantly vibrating, the whole hormonal system constantly, moving this sensitive creature through the world. And that vibrating and that grasping is what becomes identified as a self. One, there's a recognition of, I am doing this. I am finding the pleasant, and I am finding the unpleasant. And combined with this push to survive and exist, there's a protection that is happening at this root level, not just of the brain, but again, of the whole body. And the survival is no longer just of this body. For this threat to the self is a threat of death. It's not just some sort of like, oh, I feel bad that, this is too scary for me and I'm just going to sort of take a little vacation. No, this is a death threat, this threat to the self. And as this organism moves through the world, the relation with others is reflecting back, this is who you are. And there's all kinds of psychological theories about attachment theory and all this kind of stuff that says a lot about how that happens. But if you look elementally, it's just natural that we are part of the system. We are not an isolated unit. Not one of us is an isolated unit. We couldn't possibly survive. We couldn't survive. The infant cannot survive without the mother or a surrogate. It's not possible. Can't get its food or anything. So immediately, the pleasure is associated with another person, but so is survival. So deep in these patterns of networks and hormones that make who we are, this sense of self is already completely interwoven with others. Inextricable. Cannot separate it out. And there are aspects, there are structures in the brain that are dedicated to cementing those relationships, those patterns. And as we move through looking for the pleasures and avoiding the displeasures, one of the tremendous displeasures is a threat to the self. And so this bhava tanha just grows and grows, and the I, the me, that moves through life pretty soon feels like you and I feel right now. Here I am. The Buddha spoke about I and me and mine. The I is this subjective sense of agency in the world. I can live my life and so on and so forth. And I am feeling this, and I am scared of this, and I want to live, and all this kind of thing. The me is the sense I have of what you do to me. It's me as the object. And so I carry around this me that's like either a, sometimes I'm a victim, the me, or sometimes me is the one that's going to get some benefit from something that I've done. And mine is, of course, how I come to exist through what I own. I have three sons. To the extent that they are my sons, I identify with them. I take life through them. I have a wife. I live on an island. That all those self-forming mine, I, me, and mine, constantly moving around till it's true. And it's held in place by this constant urge and the tension and gripping around experience that comes with it. Now to feed this I form a character. And a character forms, I should say. So I have strategies by which I will exist by you seeing me. Because if you don't see me, it's like a strike in my heart. It's like death. I have to be seen to exist, just like the infant, right? It's not new. It's just the same pattern, only it's more nuanced and complex. So I exist through you seeing me just as much as I did when I was 1 year old. That's how it works. That's how the sense of self comes to be. So you see me, and this hunger is temporarily satisfied. Well, now I better make sure it keeps getting satisfied. I better become a meditation teacher so you can all look at me, Or I better do something well, And when this strategy doesn't work, I'll try this one. Well, I guess I'm not going to be a fashion designer or a basketball player. I'll be a meditation teacher. But seriously, the sense of you actually looking at me is validating my sense of existence right now, right? And my looking back at you, right? And this is happening because, remember, the structures in the brain are built specifically to ensure this, because that's ensured the survival of the human species. It's exactly this kind of bonding, the pleasure and the existence in it, that allowed us to work together, be sensitive to each other, and by being sensitive to each other, we could work together more efficiently. That's the tribe that would survive when the famine came or when the animals attacked, because we could work together. And then, of course, there's competing force of me surviving over you, even if we're in the same tribe. But I'm not going to get into that dynamic. So this bhava tanha is, again, constantly present, constantly becoming. Every sense contact becomes, I am experiencing seeing you, or I am experiencing hearing a bell. Constantly I, me, and it's held in place by this tension and this desire, this hunger, gripping, instant by instant, constantly reforming the world out of a pure miasmatic experience. Helps me make sense of the world, helps me control the world. That's why when you come to advanced stages in meditation, it's so hard to let go, because the world dissolves. That's the death of the self. Same thing with insanity. Same thing with bad drug trips. And the order that we create in our lives to hold it together so this self can be secure. It's quite tender, really. So we come to the third and last of these three tanha hungers, which is the hunger for non-being, a hunger for non-becoming. And here, again, let's drop back down to our native sensitivity as organisms. You know, have you ever had a large abrasion? When I was a kid, I was riding my bike with my eyes closed. And I hit a parked car. Okay, I wasn't so smart. It was cool for about a second. I hit a parked car, I didn't have a shirt on, I was on a paved road, and my chest was like raw. And, you know, I scraped along the pavement. I went over the top of my bike and just... You couldn't touch it. You couldn't touch me. It's like just every nerve ending just exposed to the air. Was just intensely painful. We're all like that, all the time. Not just when our skin gets scraped off. We're like that with our eyes and our ears, and so on. So sensitive. And the mind, this brilliant mind, this brilliant, out-of-control mind, so sensitive, you know? It's not just a contact. It's the contact and all that it means and all my personality. And it's like, oh, it's so much. So sensitive. And so I spend my whole life constructing ways of coping with that. Keeping it at bay. But I just have to get out. Sometimes you have to get out. And this getting out, this withdrawing from the world, because it's too much. Dukkha is too much. Even just sensory dukkha, but relational dukkha. The dukkha in my own mind. It's too much. I can't handle it all. Get me out. So, of course, I developed strategies because it's always like this, and it's been like this since I was an infant. I am still that raw. Every one of us is. And what are my strategies? Well, I can tell you some I don't use, but that are really common. Television, drugs, alcohol. Overwork, oversex, fantasy, dulling the mind with just about anything, running away, closing off. And not only is this sensory world too much, this relational world is too much. So now, in my bhava tanha, I really want you to see me so I can feel so great. You know, I'm going to get a Ferrari and you're going to see me, or I'm going to become a great athlete and you're going to see me, or I'm going to dye my hair a certain color, you're going to see me, or I'm going to get hair, whatever. And you'll see me, you know. And then I get old and I lose my hair, or I, you know, my breasts droop or something, and then I don't exist anymore and I feel bad about it. So I'll get myself some implants, you know. That's the strategies. And if that doesn't work, I'll go on Facebook, because then I can get seen by everyone. You know, there's a million strategies for getting seen, but to get not seen, how do we hide? And this same being that wants to be seen is just can't take being seen also. It's too intimate. It's too much. Your eyes looking at me is too much. So this vibhava tanha yields this fear of intimacy, fear of being with another, undefended, out of control. It's not okay. So now, instead of like bhava tanha always going forward into the world, the vibhava tanha is always retreating, running back from the world. And I form not only the strategies like alcohol and so on, personality strategies. Out of my face, dude. My strategies might include something like introversion and, you know, antisocial behavior, and even to the point of social phobia or something like that. But I also might have the strategy of a gregarious facade. And so to you, I look all peachy and happy and I'm a really good salesman or something. And no one gets in. So it doesn't look one way or another. But it all has that hunger to get out, unto suicide, the ultimate escape. And vibhava tanha is tanha. It is a craving, a hunger. And so the urge expressed through meditation to get out is also a hunger. And meditation as an escape. And this is common, very common. So the patina of calm is a shield, can be a shield, behind which the meditator seeks to get away rather than know the actualities of this human life. This sensitive human life. How many times have I seen seasoned Vipassana meditators come to an insight dialogue retreat and absolutely be unable to be in front of another person? It's still just sensory contact. I mean, it's nothing, right? It's just something visible and audible touches the eye and the ear. If you want to analyze it, that's all that's going on, right? Why is it so impossible? Especially for someone who's been, you know, in deep practice for so many years. Because of just what I'm saying. The whole constructing process of self is activated, and the urges in both see me, help me exist, and oh no, that is way too much. Vibhava tanha. So this Dhamma that I've just shared is something that we can contemplate and we can touch. And as I said, I normally wouldn't introduce it this late in retreat. It just feels like there's still something a little crusty that wants to, you know, get real here. And I hope that this is of benefit when we practice together. Now that you've been patient enough to sit through this talk, the actual meditation instructions, thankfully, can be very short. So thanks for listening, and we'll take a break.